Welcome to the midlife crisis episode of the Iron Rod Podcast. Searcher, the big 5-0. What do you think?
Well, I've been in a midlife crisis for the last few years anyway, so because I'm in my 50s. You're still in your 40s. So actually, I think this podcast kind of splits the difference to a certain degree between our ages. So, you know, maybe it's appropriate that we call it the midlife crisis episode.
Well, I'll have to take your word on the whole midlife crisis thing, but
you'll always be younger than I.
Well, hey, this week we're going to jump in, starting with 1 Nephi chapter 3, which is really all about the brass plates, a story we're all familiar with. But I think as we'll go through the discussion today, we're going to find there's a lot of aspects that we may not be familiar with that are right under our noses here in the text.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here, and you know, I think we could really delve deep into this story because it gives us a lot of information about the worldview of Lehi and Nephi and their brothers and what was going on at Jerusalem. And if you don't read it very carefully or actually go to other sources, you don't really understand how dangerous things were in Jerusalem. Maybe I can just start by interjecting here that, last week we observed that Lehi and his family were rich, and they were kind of part of the aristocracy in that part of the world. You know, I've read some things that suggest that he may have been a merchant that ran caravans and did some other things, because we know that he certainly had the equipment to move his family with tents and probably camels and all the provisions. You know, we don't have anything in the text that suggested that, you know, he took a year to gather all this stuff together and figure out how to do it. He may have had it right there because that's part of his trade, and perhaps that's how he got his wealth. I'm speculating here, but it's
maybe
it's
he was a prepper. Did you ever think about that?
Maybe. You know, maybe he's just anticipating that all hell's going to break loose and he's going to have to just move out of town, and he's got all of his food storage and he's got his generator and he's got his car that's going to start after an EMP and he's ready to get out of Dodge.
That's right.
So that's entirely possible here.
The text does not preclude that. So don't rule it out.
Okay. I won't rule it out, but he seems at home in the desert, and this is where he finds himself, in his tent in the desert. Oh, and by the way, Nibley observes that when we read brass plates, that's a more recent naming of an alloy, and it's probably bronze that those plates were written on, was bronze, which is an alloy of copper and tin, not an alloy of copper and zinc. Not that this is a big deal, but just for your Gee Whiz collection.
You just rocked my testimony. My whole testimony was based on zinc, and
they took that away from me. Didn't Joseph understand that it was bronze, not brass?
Well, let's take a quick look at what these plates of brass actually have. In verse 3 of chapter 3, it says, "For behold, Laban has the record of the Jews and also a genealogy of my forefathers, and they are engraved upon plates of brass. Wherefore the Lord has commanded me that thou and thy brothers should go into the house of Laban and seek the records and bring them down hither into the wilderness." So he gives us a brief description of what's on these plates. Later on in chapter 5, after they've received them and Lehi searches through them, he gives a more detailed accounting of what's in there. And so in verse 11, we learn that they contain the 5 books of Moses, and a record of the Jews from the beginning, even down to the commencement of the reign of Zedekiah, and also the prophecies of the holy prophets from the beginning, even down to the commencement of the reign of Zedekiah, and also many prophecies which have been spoken of by the mouth of Jeremiah. And it also had a genealogy of Lehi's fathers, wherefore he knew that he was a descendant of Joseph. And then in verse 16, it has this really curious phrase. It says, "And thus my father Lehi did discover the genealogy of his fathers. And Laban was also a descendant of Joseph, wherefore he and his fathers had kept the records." Did Lehi not know his genealogy? Is this discovery, I never knew this before? Or is this discovery, I had the oral tradition, but now I've actually got the written records that fill in all the blanks?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to lean towards the latter, but we're speculating here. It seems like there was some sort of a discovery that went on. You know, the other thing that we find in this that we'll get to a little bit later is that Laman is able to get an audience with Laban pretty easily. It's not like they were like total strangers. And I don't know how he got himself in for that interview with Laban, mm-hmm. but, you know, maybe they'd never met, but obviously they were aware of him and his power and his prestige as a high government official in Jerusalem. But, you know, usually just some guy off the street doesn't get an audience with some really important governmental official, but Laman is able to do that. And maybe it's because he pulls a family connection or knows something that they're connected somehow. I don't know. Again, we're speculating.
But it is something to note. There's something there. We just don't know what it is.
Well, and something that you discussed before we started the podcast today, you know, the Assyrians had kind of taken over the area of the 10 tribes. So it's highly likely that Lehi and his family sometime previous had fled south of the demarcation line between the land of Judah and where the Assyrians had come in, and is a refugee there perhaps from lands mm-hmm. of inheritance. Because if he had been from the land of Manasseh, the tribe of Manasseh, which is of Joseph, that's way north. That's way up by the Sea of Galilee. That's not anywhere close to Jerusalem. We're talking vast distances of 100 miles or more. If that's where Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh had their inheritance, it was way far north. The fact that they're not slaves to the Assyrians and in captivity tells us that they were south. They were in the lands of Judah.
Because, 100 plus years before this is happening, the Assyrians came in, wiped out the northern kingdom, and took all the people into captivity and then imported a different people that became the Samaritans. So mm-hmm. the people living up in the land of Manasseh were not the people of Manasseh anymore. So Lehi's ancestors likely had fled down to the kingdom mm-hmm. of Judah. And that's why you've got Lehi from the tribe of Manasseh living at Jerusalem.
Yeah, and Nephi gives us this little detail that his father had lived in the land of Jerusalem all his days, which, you know, I think that we got to make a distinction between the city of Jerusalem and the land of Jerusalem, the land being kind of the state and then the capital city being Jerusalem, both being called Jerusalem. Yeah. So he was clearly not in that area that had been invaded by the Assyrians.
Yeah. So another interesting thing I get from chapter 5 here is that Laban is the one who's keeping these records. And it says that the brass plates have the prophecies of the holy prophets, even down to the reign of Zedekiah. And chapter 1 starts out in the first year of the reign of Zedekiah. Mm-hmm. And it says it even has the prophecies spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah. Well, Jeremiah is alive right then. So Laban, even though he appears to be a pretty wicked dude, has been keeping the records updated with prophecies of Jeremiah and all of these other happenings right up until the reign of the current king, which is, again, odd. If he was as wicked as we think he was, why would he be obeying the commandment and keeping the records up to date?
Do you think that he's doing it himself or he has some? No, of course, he's probably not doing it.
But he's probably paying someone to do it. Whether he's doing it directly or indirectly, he is causing it to be updated.
It begs the question, if Zoram, this servant of his, who willingly follows Nephi and his brothers into the wilderness, perhaps he is very familiar with those prophecies and he believes those prophecies. And that's why he believes Nephi when he invites him to join them. Again, I'm totally speculating, but he may actually be the person who was engraving the records.
Yeah, very possible. And the last thing I'll say about the plates is in chapter 5, verses 17 through 19, we get a prophecy that these plates of brass will go forth unto all nations, kindreds, tongues, and people, and that the plates of brass should never perish. We're told that these plates of brass contain all of the prophecies of the Lord, very much like our Old Testament does, except the precious parts haven't been taken away. And one thing to keep in mind is if you look at our current Old Testament, most scholars agree that it was heavily edited during or after the Babylonian captivity, from simple things like place names being updated to Babylonian concepts being injected into some of the stories and such. These brass plates would give us a great opportunity to see what the original record said before the influence of the Babylonian captivity. And as these editors were trying to make sense of how could we, the Lord's chosen people, be cast off and sent into Babylonian captivity, they appear to have modified the records to try and answer those questions. And these brass plates, when they do come forth, will show us what was actually taught before the Babylonian captivity.
Right, which is interesting because obviously there were other records from which we've got our current Torah, mm-hmm. the Pentateuch, you know, the five books of Moses, and then those other prophets' prophecies. Just something that comes to my mind is if it contained all of that, I wonder if it was written in this Reformed Egyptian or was it in Hebrew? Because if it were in Hebrew, those plates would be pretty big. You would think, you know, if Zoram is one guy carrying all of these and, you know, I don't know. I'm just thinking more in the physical world as to how this would actually occur. But it would seem that they could be carried by one person and that they contained all of those records of the books of Moses, the law of Moses for sure. Because when we get to the scene where Nephi is commanded to kill Laban, you know, the scene that rocks the world of some people who start to read the Book of Mormon and get there and just go, okay, I can't believe this is possible, that the Lord would ever command somebody to kill somebody else. One of the justifications for that was that they would not have the law of Moses if they didn't get these plates. They needed these plates to preserve the law of Moses among the people going forward. Someday, I think we'll get more clarity on that.
Yeah. And one thing that I kind of think about is all of the stuff that's missing in the Book of Moses. I think we have a sneak preview of that because we have very detailed story about Enoch and his ministry and everything he does. And yet in our current Old Testament, he gets like one or two lines and that's it. If that's just an example of the kind of details that have been removed from our current Old Testament, boy, there's going to be a lot of light and knowledge that comes forth when those brass plates come forth.
Especially as it points to Zion and what God is trying to establish in the last day. So, you know, maybe that's something that the servants, including Joseph, when he comes back, is going to bring forth in terms mm-hmm. of new records for us to ponder.
Definitely agree. Those are the plates that he is commanded to go get. And then Lehi talks to Nephi, and verse 7, we get Nephi's very famous quote.
Seminary scripture of all seminary scriptures, right?
I will go, I will do, I will cut off Laban's head. Oh, that's not what we sing in primary.
No, we don't.
But Nephi does make this really provocative statement, saying that the Lord never gives a commandment except he prepares a way for the people to accomplish that commandment. That gets repeated a couple times through Nephi's record. But then a lot of modern Mormons will discount that and say, no, obviously that's not true. Because just look at Missouri. God commanded us to go build Zion and all our enemies came upon us and we weren't able to do it. And so, therefore, God really doesn't prepare a way all the time, only sometimes.
Read this more carefully, MD. You're not reading verse 7 very carefully. Save he shall prepare a way for them that they may accomplish the thing which he commandeth them. It doesn't say that no matter what, they will accomplish the thing. In all cases, he allows the people to decide if they're going to actually follow his commands or not. You know, that's
I mean, we've got agency. I'm not just like a robot that has to do what I'm commanded.
Last time I checked. I think that you're right. We can misinterpret this to say the Lord is always going to prepare a way, but we always have our agency. And the accomplishment of any big task is based upon our faithfulness. And it's why I believe that Lehi here, when he hears Nephi say this, he's exceedingly glad, for he knows that Nephi is exercising faith in the commandments of the Lord and in the Lord to help him fulfill this command to go back to Jerusalem, as opposed to his brethren who are still murmuring, saying, oh, this is a hard thing. We can't do it. There's no way. You know, Laban is a military commander, high government official that has a garrison of 50 soldiers at his beck and call. And we also learn a little detail later that he has tens of thousands, probably outside of the city, that he could call in if there were an insurrection or something. But he's a powerful guy. There's no way we can get this from him.
Yeah, God's powerful, but he's not that powerful.
No, exactly. So after Nephi says this thing to his father and his father's really happy, we have this in verse 9. And I, Nephi, and my brethren took our journey in the wilderness with our tents to go up to the land of Jerusalem. It's interesting to see how, from a geographic standpoint, Nephi describes going up and going down, going up and going down. If I were to say, I'm going to go visit you, MD, I'd say, I'm going down to visit you. Because you live south of me. And if you were to come up to see me, right, because I'm north of you, I think that's typically how we would use those terms. And that might be the case here, because Lehi definitely fled to the south from Jerusalem. But it's also interesting to note that Jerusalem is pretty high up in elevation relative to the surrounding landscape. It's at 2,474 feet above sea level. And then just to its east is the Dead Sea, which is minus 1,410 feet. So you've got a disparity there of 3,900 feet. That's pretty serious elevation gain or loss. And so we get in this narrative, the ups and the downs, you know, going up to Jerusalem. It's always talking about going up and then going down to the land of their inheritance or going down into the wilderness. It's consistent, which tells us something here. So maybe that's one for the G-Wiz file, but you know, you see how Nephi describes this.
Yeah, and you see that in the other scriptures as well. I've actually been there several times and done that drive from the Dead Sea up to Jerusalem, and it's all around. I mean, if you start in Tel Aviv, you're at the beach, and then you have to drive up to get Jerusalem. So from all 360 degrees, if you want to get to Jerusalem from anywhere else in Israel, you're going up some significant vertical climbs. And so then you can think about the frustration that they may feel when they're having to go up and down, back and forth several times.
Climb the mountain.
It's a bit of a haul.
Yeah. Especially on a camel. Hey, we don't know how they traveled, if they walked or they rode. I imagine they rode, but you know, we don't have those sorts of details.
Yep. After they go up to the land of Jerusalem, they cast lots to decide who's going to go talk to Laban.
Why do you think they did that?
Sometimes I'll read commentators that will try to explain it and say, well, they lacked faith. They left it to chance. And that's totally ignoring the ancient mindset, which was, it wasn't leaving it up to chance. It was leaving it up to God. And so casting lots was the way to say, I'm not going to make the decision. I'm going to let God make the decision. And the best example we have of this is in Acts chapter 1, where Peter and the other 10 apostles are going to go replace Judas. And they have two guys, Joseph and Matthias. And then they prayed and said, Thou Lord, which knowest the hearts of all men, show whether of these two thou hast chosen. And they gave forth their lots, and the lot fell upon Matthias, and he was numbered with the 11 apostles. I don't think we can argue that Peter and the other apostles were lacking in faith, were leaving it to random chance. They were praying to God and saying, God, here's the two we think are qualified. You tell us which one you want.
And if you look in the Law of Moses, that happens every year on the Day of Atonement, where the high priest casts lots over which goat is going to be sacrificed and which is going to be the scapegoat. So this is very contemporary with Lehi and Nephi and their families, because they're under the law of Moses. So they see this happen every time. Yeah. So they're saying, okay, Lord, who do you choose? Essentially, yep. We're going to cast lots. And guess what? It's the oldest.
Yeah. So we get the oldest, who I guess if you're really focused on firstborn birthrights and such, it would be his duty as the future head of the clan to take charge. He goes in, has the meeting, and is unsuccessful, and he's driven out.
I think it's worth noting in verse 13 that Laban accuses Laman of being a robber. He falsely accuses him and says, you're trying to rob these things from me, and sends him out. So this is the first transgression, really, of Laban that lines up here. I think the Lord is giving him a chance to do the right thing, but in the first instance, he falsely accuses somebody of trying to steal from him, and then he tries to go kill him. This is where Laban is setting himself up to be worthy of being delivered into the hands of Nephi.
Good point. After Laman flees out of his presence, the brothers regroup, and they're basically saying, all right, let's go back to Dad and tell him it didn't work. And then Nephi stands up and actually makes an oath, and he says, as the Lord lives and as we live, we will not go down unto our father in the wilderness until we have accomplished the thing which the Lord has commanded us. That's like the triple dog dare of ancient Israel. He's swearing both on the life of the Lord and on his own life that they're going to accomplish this thing.
Right. What we don't recognize in our society is that the oaths of ancient Arabia and Israel were sacred. And if you uttered an oath like this, you didn't break it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why actually when we get to Zoram, we'll see that the way that Nephi placates Zoram is to utter this same oath to him and promise on the life of the Lord and on his own life, on his own head, that he would not be harmed and that he would have place with them. These are things that in our modern society where so many people will promise something and then go, just kidding. Stupid you. You believed me. I didn't really mean it. The oath of those people was a sacred oath. And if they uttered it in this way, it meant I'm going to die trying. Essentially, Nephi is saying, I am not going down to my father without those plates. I'll either be dead or we're getting the plates. It's that sort of a sacred oath. And, you know, it's easy to just skim over those words and not really realize, you know, how determined Nephi was to follow the commandments of the Lord and get those plates.
So after he says that, they go down to the land of their inheritance. And as we discussed earlier, you know, we don't know if that's north, south, east, or west, but it's down. They had to climb down from the elevated heights of
Jerusalem. It's probably not north. Or not much north.
Not okay. Very far north.
Yeah. Not very far north. It's probably south, southeast, southwest, but it's not far north.
So they go back there and they gather up all their things, their gold and their silver, and they come in, they present it to Laban. And when Laban saw our property, he did lust after it insomuch that he thrust us out and sent his servants to slay us that he might obtain our property. So whereas in the first time he just threatened to kill him, this time he actually sent the servants to go do the deed, and they had to escape for their life.
Right. This is strike two against him, because now he's actively tried to murder them.
Yep.
And in fact, I find this description, and again, this is kind of a portrait of Laban that Hugh Nibley wrote in an essay that's in a collection called An Approach to the Book of Mormon. But I find it interesting just based on the historical records of what a high official in the government would be like back then. He was active and patriotic, attending committee meetings at all hours of the night. He was shrewd and quick, promptly recognizing his right and seizing his opportunity to confiscate the property with which Nephi and his brethren attempted to bribe him, a public official. And this is my commentary here, because that was just the way business was done back then. You know, bribery was probably rampant, that sort of corruption. The young men wanted some family records from him. They wanted them very badly, but would not tell what they wanted them for. They were willing to pay almost anything to get them. There was obviously something shady about the deal from Laban's point of view. Very well, he could keep his mouth shut, but would it be sound business practice to let the plates go for nothing? With his other qualifications, Laban was a big, impressive figure of a man, not a man to be intimidated, outsmarted, worn down, or trifled with. He was every inch an executive, yet he plainly knew how to unbend and get drunk with the boys at night. One of the main functions of any governor in the East was always to hear petitions, and the established practice has ever been to rob the petitioners or anyone else whenever possible. So this is the sort of guy that would have been in that position that Laban was in. And so he's exercising his power. He's stealing whatever he can. The conspiracies are rampant. He's probably wondering, what do these guys want this for? Are they going to use it against me? You know, they seem to be willing to want it really badly, and they're bribing me for it. So, you know, the intrigue and that part of it, I'm sure that vast novels could be written if we had more detail here about about what was going on in Jerusalem at this point in time.
Yeah,
it makes our politics pale in comparison, I think. They get outside the city. They've just been fleeing from Laban's men who are trying to kill them. They hide themselves. And Laman and Lemuel start to beat their younger brothers. And this angel appears to them. And you would think that this would convince them that it's all okay. And yet, even after this, they show a complete lack of faith. And they begin to murmur, saying, how is it possible? And here's where we get the fact that Laban is commanding 50. Yes, he can command 50. Yea, even he can slay 50. Then why not us? Despite seeing an angel, despite having promises of the Lord, they just can't muster any faith in this. And they're just relying on the wisdom of men. They were ready to give up after the first attempt. That lack of faith, I think, just really shows the difference between Nephi and Sam and Laman and Lemuel. Simply yeah. That.
And that true conversion is only when the Spirit works on you. Because you can see the miracles, you can see the angel, but if the Holy Spirit hasn't worked on your spirit, it's not going to change anything. You're still right. The natural man.
Yes, that's exactly true. So after this, Nephi tries to placate his brothers and convince them. And the analogy he uses is he says, let us go up. This is verse 2 of chapter 4. Let us go up and let us be strong like unto Moses. For he truly spake unto the waters of the Red Sea, and they divided hither and thither. So he's painting these pictures saying, listen, the Lord did all these great things. You know it's true. You know that the children of Israel were delivered from the Egyptians and their armies were drowned in the Red Sea. Why can you doubt? He did this for Moses. He can do this for us. This is a small thing compared to the tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Israelites that were led out of Egypt. So he says in verse 3, let us go up. The Lord is able to deliver us, even as our fathers, and to destroy Laban, even as the Egyptians. And when he spoke these words, they were yet wroth, it says, and did still continue to murmur. Nevertheless, they did follow me until we came without the walls of Jerusalem. You know, then we have him going in by himself. And I think it's interesting to note that cities at night were not safe places. All the nefarious things that were going on would happen at night because murders could happen, robberies could happen, all of that. That's why we have the thief in the night analogy that comes through in the scriptures. There were no street lamps. Maybe the moon shining, maybe not. But if it's dark, you have no idea who's around the next corner looking to stab you in the back. Nephi is creeping into this very dangerous situation, as he said, led by the Spirit, not knowing beforehand what he's going to have to do.
And you think about the political events that have been going on. Babylon has been coming in and exerting its influence, pulling kings off the thrones and deporting them to Babylon and setting, you know, Zedekiah was placed on his throne by Babylon. Egypt had been agitating, trying to get the kingdom of Judah to back them in a power play against Babylon. Yeah,
the conspiracies are thick.
There were probably a lot of really sketchy people from Egypt and from Babylon that were hanging around Jerusalem. Yeah, who knows what kind of stuff was going on in the shadows at this time.
Who's sending their spies? Who can you trust? Who can't you trust? I mean, the intrigue is rampant.
Well, so now we get into this instance, which it's challenging. It's definitely a big deal. Nephi comes walking up and he sees a drunk guy laying in the street. And lo and behold, it's Laban. And he tells us, it came to pass that I was constrained by the spirit that I should kill Laban.
Gosh, Nephi wrestles with this, right? First, he pulls out his sword and he looks at it and it's like, there must have been some moon because he sees that it's of pure gold, the workmanship exceedingly fine, precious steel. And as he's holding this sword, the spirit says, use it on him. I'm sure it was just curiosity that led him to pull out the sword. And then it's like, oh my gosh, the Lord wants me to use it. He shrinks back from this. Obviously, it's like, I've never killed anybody in my life. This is a sin. He's wrestling with the sinful aspect of what he's about to do or what he thinks is sinful. And then the Spirit says, he's delivered into your hands. Obviously, Nephi's writing this after the fact, so he's probably had time to process this. But he goes through and he says, okay, well, I knew that he had tried to kill us. I knew that he was rebellious against the Lord and he had stolen our property. And so he had done all these things that under the law of Moses would allow you to take somebody's life if they had done that against you.
Right. And yet, even though he comes up with all those things, he's still resisting. He's like, yeah, he's done all that stuff, but I'm still not ready to do that.
Right. I mean, just, yeah, imagine it. He wasn't the king, but he was a high official, obviously, in Jerusalem that somebody must have found the next day with his head chopped off and his armor gone.
Now, this is something where, while I've never been commanded to go cut someone's head off, I've had two experiences in my life where the Spirit has constrained me to do something that I thought was a sin. And I went through a very similar experience to Nephi where I was trying, no, I'm not going to do, I've never done that. And we've got examples from the scriptures where Ezekiel is commanded to cook his food over human dung. And he's like, whoa, that's like totally against the law of Moses. I ain't doing that. And similarly with Peter, when he has the vision and he's commanded to eat all the unclean animals. He's like, whoa, time out. I ain't doing that.
Right.
And you could even go to Abraham, where he's commanded to slay his own son. You know, I look at this and I say, if it was just a question of getting Laban out of the picture, the Lord could have had him choke on his vomit. The Lord could have made him have a heart attack. The Lord could have had fire come down of heaven and kill him. So if the purpose was just to kill Laban, there were plenty of other ways the Lord could have done it. So right. I don't think the purpose was to kill Laban. I think the purpose was to teach Nephi a lesson. You know, you look at what Nephi's doing. He's like, he's trying to refer back to, oh, I've got all these commandments, so I don't have to listen to what the Lord is commanding me right in this moment to do. I'm going to fall back on what I've been taught. And it really looks like the Lord is saying, no, when I speak to you, you need to listen to what I'm saying at this moment, just like Abraham did, just like Peter did. That's a real test of faith to be able to say, gosh, am I going to adhere to the commandments that I know and believe in? Or am I going to follow the voice of the Lord right now? That's a tough test for Nephi. And in this case, the stakes were really high. This was not something minor that he was being asked to do. This was crossing the Rubicon. There was no going back after this one.
Yeah, I mean, that principle, though, to me, I think you have to be really careful about, because how many atrocities have been committed in the name of somebody believing that the Lord had told them to do something when in fact it's obvious that he hadn't. But the logic here really flows for Nephi, because he was told that the Lord would deliver Laban into their hands and that it would be successful. And it's only after three attempts. You know, the Lord gave Laban two tries to give over the brass plates, and he didn't. And he became a murderer in that process. So, and then we get this discussion in verse 13, where Nephi tells us, "Behold, the Lord slayeth the wicked to bring forth his righteous purposes. It is better that one man should perish than that a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief." Which is obviously a reference to the Nephite nation in the Americas, that if they didn't have these records, they most likely would perish and dwindle in unbelief without the law and without the records.
An interesting thing with that phrase is there's two precedents from history. So the first one happens in 2 Samuel 20, where there's this rebel who is threatened King David. His name's Sheba. And so David sends his army off to go take care of this rebel, and he flees into the city of Abel, and David's army surrounds the city, and they're like, "Send him out to us or we're going to kill y'all. We'll just level the city." And the people inside the city quickly consult, and they chop off Sheba's head, throw it over the wall, and the army goes, "Oh, we're good," and they dissipate. And so that's where this idea of it's better than one person die than the whole city be wasted came about. And then just a few years before this, it happened again. Jehoiakim had been the king of Judah, and he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. And this was during Lehi and Nephi's life when this happened. And so Nebuchadnezzar goes to the Jewish council at Antioch, and he demands the surrender of Jehoiakim, or Babylon's going to come in and wipe out the kingdom of Judah. And Jehoiakim protests, and he says, "Can you sacrifice one life for another?" And the council replied, "Thus did your ancestors do to Sheba." So we've already done it.
And so there's precedent for this.
Based on that ruling, Jehoiakim was handed over to Nebuchadnezzar and taken off to Babylon in captivity. And then Zedekiah was established as the new king of Judah because they had turned over Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar. This concept was probably really fresh on Nephi's mind because he had just seen it played out with the king of Judah.
And with the shifting alliances, I mean, even when we look at modern day with these various tribes in some of the nearby countries, you know, Afghanistan and those sorts of places where loyalties shift all the time, just in the name of preservation from one side to another. Everyone's trying to figure out who's going to win this battle and who they should align themselves with. It sounds really tiring to me to try to figure this out, but it's self-preservation. It's the only way that you can survive in that sort of a scenario. Because if you're not aligned with the right people, you're in trouble. And that's the sort of world that Lehi and Nephi came from.
So we read in verse 18 that after all of this deliberation and after all of the rationales, then he says, "Therefore, I did obey the voice of the Spirit, and I took Laban by the hair of the head, and I smote off his head with his own sword." So in the end, Nephi obeys the voice of the Spirit and does what he's asked to do.
And I always wondered in this scenario, I mean, that's a real bloody way to off somebody. And then you've got Nephi, who puts on his clothes and his armor, and obviously it's dark, and maybe the armor was impervious to, you know, the blood. Maybe he did something to lessen the amount of blood or something, put his head downhill and let it drain for a while or something.
That's the way I'd do it.
I don't know, but I've always wondered about that. But then he puts on his armor, puts on his garments, and as we know, he goes forth to the treasury of Laban. And this is a really interesting scene here where he's able to somehow speak, probably in the gruff commanding voice of Laban, to his servant Zoram. This servant Zoram is the person who has the keys of the treasury. Nephi says, "Get these records." And because Laban's been out among the elders of the Jews, Zoram thinks that, well, we're going to take these to this meeting. These guys are out having a meeting. Maybe they want to consult these records because there's all this intrigue going on. I got to go get it. And there's like this immediacy that they get the records, and you know, Nephi in the voice of Laban says, follow me. We're going to go to our brethren. Now, he was obviously meeting his own personal brothers outside, not the elders of the Jews, but this convinces Zoram to then follow him. And they get outside, and now Laman and Lemuel are scared to death because they see who they think is Laban, who's probably killed their brother, they think, and out to kill them. And they're scared. And then Nephi goes, hey, it's me behind this armor and with this sword. And now Zoram's scared.
So one other interesting thing about Zoram, and this is something we received in an email from one of our listeners, so hat tip to our listener, but it appears that he was a Levite. So if you look in the book of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 26:20 talks about, and of the Levites, Ahijah had charge of the treasuries of the house of God and the treasuries of the dedicated gifts. And 1 Chronicles 29:8, whosoever had precious stones gave them to the treasury of the house of the Lord in the care of Jehiel the Gershonite. And Gershon was the eldest son of Levi. So it seems in an era when you didn't have banks and you didn't have vaults, that if you had something precious, you put it in the temple, because that place was always protected and no one's going to go try to rip off the temple. But then, of course, if you're an invading army, the temple's the first place.
You're going straight to the temple and you're going to ransack the temple and you're going to steal all the stuff.
So it would seem that if Zoram had the keys to the treasury, it's probably likely that he was a Levite himself, which then when you think about Nephi having to go out into the wilderness and live the law of Moses, he wasn't a Levite. He was from the tribe of Manasseh. And so with Zoram coming, they likely had a Levite who could actually officiate in the temple that they built in the New World.
Yes, yeah, it's interesting. Of course, it's not explicitly stated, but the circumstantial evidence really points in that direction. I mean, the other thing that we learn about Zoram, he's called a servant, but that would have been a very prestigious position that he held if he's got the keys of the treasury. You know, it's not like just some slave, although, you know, Nephi tells him that you'll be free if you're with us. It's pretty obvious to me that he doesn't have a family because he follows them. If he had a wife and kids, if he had them, he'd be abandoning them. But he doesn't seem to say anything. The text doesn't indicate anything like that. He follows them. So he was probably a single, you know, male Levite, most likely, that had the priesthood and the keys of the treasury and took that into the New World with them. Obviously, Zoram is scared. And again, we have Nephi uttering this oath to him. It says in verse 32, and it came to pass that I spake with him that he would hearken unto my words. As the Lord liveth and as I live, on my life and on the Lord's life, I swear unto you, even so, if he would hearken unto our words, we would spare his life. And I spake unto him, even with an oath, that he need not fear, that he should be a free man like unto us, if he would go down into the wilderness with us. And I also spake unto him, saying, surely the Lord hath commanded us to do this thing, and shall we not be diligent in keeping the commandments of the Lord? Therefore, if thou wilt go down into the wilderness, thou shalt have place with us. And it came to pass that Zoram did take courage. Now Zoram was the name of the servant. This is where we first learn his name. And he promised that he would go down into the wilderness unto our father. Yea, he made an oath unto us that he would tarry with us from that time forth. And obviously they didn't want him to go back to Jerusalem because he blabbed to everybody saying, hey, and you know, an army may have gone out 3 days march to wipe out Lehi and his tents and his party. But in verse 37, and it came to pass that when Zoram made an oath unto us, our fears did cease concerning him. It just speaks to how valuable an oath was in that society, a real foreign concept to us today.
And it's interesting that they both make oaths. Nephi makes the oath that will take care of you. And then Zoram makes the oath, all right, I'll go along with you and won't try to run away.
And everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah.
At least at that point in time.
Yeah, and then from all the records we have, from that point on, he is equal to the rest of the family, and his clan is just as entitled to the rights as Jacob and Nephi's and all the others.
Yep, exactly.
So we get to chapter 5, and they return with the plates, and we get this little incident with Sariah. You know, there aren't a whole lot of times where we get to hear about the women or even hear the words of the women in the Book of Mormon. And this is one of them. And sometimes people kind of throw Sariah under the bus and say, oh, she was lacking faith. I don't think that's quite the case. So when we look at what it says here, starting in verse 1, it says that Sariah was exceedingly glad, for she truly had mourned because of us. So, well, she's been mourning. Why? For she had supposed that we had perished in the wilderness. And she had also complained against my father, telling him that he was a visionary man. And so the first thing is, she's not complaining against the Lord. And we see in plenty of other instances where even Lehi himself complains against the Lord and murmurs against the Lord. Sariah is only complaining against Lehi. And she says that he was a visionary man. And we think, oh, well, that means he was, you know, this great prophet. But when you go look up in the Webster 1828 dictionary, it means affected by phantoms, disposed to receive impressions on the imagination, existing in imagination only. So she's like, dude, you're delusional. You're having these dreams, and I've got no evidence that what you're saying is true.
Well, and what we don't know is how long this journey takes. We don't have a day count of how long it took them to go up to Jerusalem. We know they had fled 3 days into the wilderness, so at least 3 days to get back. Then they have an attempt. Then they go get their property. Then they go try to bribe Laban. We don't know how far they had to go to get their property. This could have been many weeks or months that it took them to go into the wilderness. And she obviously knows that maybe they're 3 or 4 days from their lands, but how far from the actual city of Jerusalem? You know, she's counting the days, and they're supposed to be back on day 7, and here it is day 14 or whatever that number is. She's worried. And, you know, in verse 8, it says, you know, once they'd come back, now I know of a surety that the Lord hath commanded my husband to flee into the wilderness. Yea, I also know of a surety that the Lord hath protected my sons and delivered them out of the hands of Laban and given them power whereby they could accomplish the thing which the Lord hath commanded them. You know, she was believing in Lehi, and I think it got more and more difficult as time passed, and she realized, man, they're probably not coming home. They're probably dead. And we're gonna die here in the wilderness. All 4 of our sons are gone and we're old. What are we gonna do? I mean, I imagine that those are the sorts of thoughts that were going through her head.
Yeah, and we have no record of her receiving a spiritual confirmation that Lehi was truly called of God. It isn't until the sons come back that she says, now I know of a surety that the Lord has commanded my husband to flee. Before, she didn't know of a surety. She was trusting in her husband, but she didn't have any sort of spiritual confirmation, it would seem. And now she's got it. And we never hear about Sariah complain again after this.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why the Lord let this play out the way it was. I mean, he was testing people. He was giving them the chance to finally see his miracles result in a deliverance. And Sariah probably had to go through that to really gain that testimony that this is the will of the Lord. I've seen the miracle. We've been led out of the land of Egypt with a strong hand, so to speak. In this case, Jerusalem, but just like Moses and the children of Israel.
Yeah, in fact, in Ether 12, we learn that the Lord doesn't give us a witness until after the trial of our faith. And so this appears to have been the trial of faith for Sariah. And then she doesn't curse the Lord. She doesn't complain against the Lord, just against her husband. And when the sons come back, now she gets the answer. She's received her witness.
And some people, even though they go through the trial of the faith, if they're not faithful in that process, don't see the miracle. Nephi demonstrated great faith, and that's why at the end of the day, he was able to see that miracle. I mean, I don't think if just Laman and Lemuel had gone, that they would have experienced that because they didn't exercise their faith. They wanted to go back after strike one. And after strike two, then they're striking Nephi, no pun intended. And finally, third time it works. So anyway, they get the brass plates. We've already gone over what's on those and how important those were. Chapter 5 ends with, "Wherefore it was wisdom in the Lord that we should carry them with us as we journeyed in the wilderness towards the land of promise." And 21, "even of great worth, insomuch that we could preserve the commandments of the Lord unto our children." So obviously the Lord wanted them to have them. And a lot of, I don't know how many pages or how, you know, in Reformed Egyptian, how long it took to tell this story. But, you know, it's pregnant with a lot of meaning for us, even today.
There's one other interesting thing in verse 9, and it says, "It came to pass that they did rejoice exceedingly and did offer sacrifice and burnt offerings unto the Lord, and they gave thanks unto the God of Israel." Sacrifice and burnt offerings are in the law of Moses. A sacrifice was an offering of thanksgiving. They're also called peace offerings in the Old Testament. And you can read about those in Leviticus 3, 7, and 22. But burnt offerings are an atonement offering. This presumes that someone has been defiled and there needs to be a decontamination. They're no longer clean and they need to be ceremonially cleansed. And I was kind of thinking about this. I'm like, well, what happened on that experience that would cause someone to be defiled? And the one that came to mind is Nephi actually touched a dead body. He killed Laban and then he undressed him. And that's specifically in the law of Moses in Numbers 19, starting in verse 11. "Whoever touches the dead body of any person shall be unclean 7 days." And in verse 13, "Whoever touches a dead person, the body of anyone who has died, and does not cleanse himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel." So if that's the case, Nephi is coming back unclean, and if he doesn't clean himself, he's going to be cut off from Israel. Basically, they take some of the ashes from the burnt offering, they add it to water, and then they use that to cleanse the impure person. And that's how they cleanse someone who has touched a dead body. And Nephi obviously has touched a dead body as a result of his actions. Which then leads to the other question of, well, Lehi wasn't a Levite. So who performed this burnt offering so that they could get the ashes so that they could clean Nephi? So we've really got two options here. We've got the Zoram hypothesis. So maybe he was a Levite, and so maybe he's the one who's able to go offer these. But we also know that when Lehi first left, he offered sacrifice out in the wilderness as well before Zoram was in the picture. A lot of times, Mormon commentators will just say, well, he had the Melchizedek priesthood. Joseph Smith taught that all the prophets had the Melchizedek priesthood. Therefore, Lehi had the Melchizedek priesthood, and so he could officiate in the offices of the Aaronic priesthood and what the Levites had to do. And so Lehi was doing that, which then begs the question, if you have the traditional Mormon mindset, who did he receive the Melchizedek priesthood from? There's no record of him going to Jeremiah.
Where's his line of authority?
Exactly.
who laid hands on him and made him a prophet? Well, I mean, I think the answer is really simple. When you understand what it takes to be called to the Melchizedek priesthood, it's not just to get called into a bishopric or a high council and suddenly the stake president calls you and says, you know, we want to call you into this and we're going to give you the Melchizedek priesthood. Or that's a high priest, obviously, but we're taught that that's when you receive the Melchizedek priesthood. But the Melchizedek priesthood is not by father or mother. It's not patriarchal in nature. It's not handed down like the Levitical priesthood that we're speculating that Zoram had. But we do know that Lehi had a divine encounter. He stood in the council of the Lord when he was called as a prophet. So I've got to believe that that's the point at which he receives that highest level of priesthood. And Nephi also, through his visions and his divine encounters, called by God himself.
In the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis 14, it talks about this high priesthood, and it says it was delivered unto men by the calling of his own voice, according to his own will, not by the hands of men and not by the timing of men. And it says, men having this faith, coming up unto this order of God, were translated and taken up into heaven. In chapter 1, we read about Lehi being translated and taken up into heaven. So, yeah, I think it's pretty logical to say Lehi received the Melchizedek priesthood by the voice of God when he was taken up into heaven. And so he could officiate in these things because he was now a high priest and fully authorized to do these things. But if we go with the traditional Mormon, you need a line of authority. There's a huge gap here.
Yeah. In Hebrews, we're taught that Jesus is the great high priest and that this priesthood cometh not by father or by mother. So it's by God himself, as you said. And the Joseph Smith translation is very clear in teaching that to us. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting point to think about, because we also know that Nephi builds a temple when he gets to the new world. And, you know, this was not to administer information that we have in our current temples. I can just guarantee you that.
It was to do the law of Moses.
Exactly. And Nephi and his other prophets in the Book of Mormon rail against secret combinations and secret information. So it's wholly inconsistent with the fullness of the gospel as contained in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. Enough said. So good point. Thank you.
So once they're done with this, the Lord then makes the request, hey, I need you to go back up again and go talk to Ishmael. And people make a lot of light of this about, gosh, didn't God realize the first time? Couldn't he have been more efficient? Or, gosh, this is the one time that Laban and Lemuel never complain about having to go up again. But I think there's a lot more meat to this story than we give it credit a lot of times. So in verse 1, the Lord talks to Lehi and tells him that his sons should take daughters to wife, that they may raise up seed unto the Lord in the land of promise. Now, does that phrase ring any bells with you, Searcher?
Jacob 2.
Jacob 2? What does it say in Jacob 2?
Jacob 2. Jacob 2 is where Jacob is railing against the Nephites because they've started to commit whoredoms and taking multiple wives. You're going to have to tell me the exact verse there, but it's in Jacob 2 where we get this passage that the Mormon church has interpreted as justifying polygamy. And I'm sure you have it right there, so go ahead and read it.
Yeah, so it starts in verse 27, and he says, there shall not any man among you have it save be one wife, and concubines he shall have none. For the Lord delights in the chastity of women, and whoredoms are an abomination before me, thus saith the Lord. Wherefore, this people shall keep my commandments, saith the Lord, or cursed shall be the land for their sakes. And then in verse 30, for if I will raise up seed unto me, I will command my people. Otherwise, they shall hearken unto these things. And as you point out, the Mormon church will try to explain that this means if the Lord wants to raise up seed, he will command polygamy. Otherwise, you have to just live monogamy. But that's not what
happens. That's not what it says.
That's not what it says, and that's not what Lehi does.
I mean, we twist that Jacob 2 verse to think that polygamy is the means by which righteous seed is raised up. But what we read here in chapter 7 is the exact opposite. It's via monogamy that a righteous seed is raised up. And Jacob 2 gets twisted when if you can read it a completely other way that says, you know, my people will commit whoredoms unless I command them. And it's been interpreted to live polygamy, to raise up righteous seed. No, it's to live the law of monogamy. Because if they don't live the law of monogamy, and I don't command them to raise up righteous seed by monogamy, then they will do these things. They will commit whoredoms and have multiple wives.
Yeah, and we've done the whole episode, two episodes on polygamy. And that's exactly what's going on here. In the law of Moses, he didn't outlaw polygamy, but he didn't condone it either. And what would happen? People would take advantage of it, and they would seek multiple wives and concubines. And so the Lord's saying, if I don't command you guys to live monogamy, you're going to go off and commit all these abominations. So I'm going to command you. And he commands Lehi. And in verse 34, it tells us right there, my brethren, ye know that these commandments were given to our father Lehi. Wherefore, ye have known them before, and ye have come unto great condemnation, for ye have not done these things which ye ought to have done.
And that's a great catch, because it relates right back to this chapter 7. To raise up righteous seed, you need to take daughters to wife. It's not daughters to wives and have multiple wives. It's have a single monogamous wife to raise up righteous seed. Right. And that's what Jacob's pointing back to. And yet we still twist and contort Jacob 2 to justify polygamy.
Yes. And if we read in 1 Nephi 7, Ishmael's family is a perfect match for Lehi's family plus Zoram. He has five daughters that aren't married. And Lehi has four sons plus Zoram that all need wives. So it's a one-to-one, but there's zero polygamy involved.
Yeah. You know, you can say, okay, why didn't the Lord tell him to do this earlier? And I don't know. We don't know exactly how long they sojourned here in this particular part of the wilderness. I mean, I've read, and this is again from Nibley, where it says, since it has ever been the custom among the desert people for a man to marry the daughter of his paternal uncle, it is hard to avoid the impression that Lehi and Ishmael were related. So they obviously knew each other, and thus he sends for them, and they probably don't all get married at the same time because of age differences, or maybe they do. Does it say here in the text?
Do you remember? No, it doesn't say.
But clearly, as you said, it's a one-to-one, and they know each other. I mean, Ishmael could have been Sarai's brother, for all we know. That's a high likelihood here, but it doesn't say explicitly.
And the other thing I'll just point out is Jacob is the son of Lehi. So he's preaching decades after this event has happened, but he's still the son of the guy that got the commandment. And now he's teaching people, this is what it means. It means monogamy. It doesn't mean polygamy. So he's really close to the source, and he's not teaching polygamy.
And it also tells you that Sarai could still have children in the wilderness. She wasn't past the childbearing years when they had fled, because she has Jacob and Joseph there in the wilderness during all their hardships in their travels.
Yep. So they go up, they talk to Ishmael. He agrees to come out to the desert with them. And now they join the party.
And also we have two sons of Ishmael in their family. So, so this makes the party even bigger, because they were married, obviously, and they agree to come on this journey with Ishmael. So we've got a pretty good size caravan here.
Yeah, you've got about 18 adults plus whatever kids are coming into the group.
Into the picture. Yeah, that's a pretty good size caravan. One of the other things we learn in chapter 7 is that Laman and Lemuel still are rebelling. They still want to go back to Jerusalem. They've married, you know, the two daughters of Ishmael, and they decide that they're going to rebel. So they've got more allies. They've tried to recruit more allies to their side, and they're still causing trouble.
Yeah. In fact, we have this encounter where Nephi kind of calls them out. And in verse 15, he says, now behold, I say unto you that if you will return unto Jerusalem, ye shall also perish with them. And now, if ye have choice, go up to the land and remember the words which I speak unto you. that if you go, you will also perish. That if you have choice is a really archaic English. It doesn't mean that you don't have your agency, but it means like, if that's what you really want, then get out, go up there, but don't forget what I told you. And when the Babylonians come and kill you,
remember I told you so.
as only a little brother can say.
Yeah, exactly. And then they tie him up, right, and say they're going to leave him in the wilderness to be devoured by wild beasts. It's amazing after all these miracles that they're not converted, which just tells us over and over again, the scriptures are full of people who, when they don't give heed to the Holy Spirit, even though they see and experience miracles, it doesn't do anything for them. They're not converted. It's only the Spirit that does that. You know, I think this last few verses of 7 is a really good place to end. And it seems like Laman and Lemuel, at least for a time, repent, that their hearts are softened because of the women who plead with them. And in verse 20, we get this from Nephi. They did plead with me that I would forgive them of the thing which they had done against me. And it came to pass that I did frankly forgive them all that they had done. And I did exhort them that they would pray unto their Lord, their God, for forgiveness. And it came to pass that they did so. And then they go with thanks into the wilderness. So, you know, Nephi, I think, is showing the largeness of his heart. And he's saying, listen, I forgive you. What you really need to go do is go to the Lord. You know, later on in 2 Nephi, or a little bit later, we'll get into Nephi's lament, which is how he feels anger in his soul. And he's pleading with God to let that go. Mm-hmm. And it's probably because of his brethren who are a constant thorn in his side. But he's still willing to forgive them as the Lord does. And I think that's a great lesson for us to end this episode on.
That is a great one, because we are commanded to forgive our enemies and love those that despise us. And
it's hard when your enemy is inside your own family and the conflict is constantly in your face right there.
Yeah, it definitely grates against the natural man. So, well, great. Thank you, Searcher. This was a great conversation. I learned a lot. Thanks for the insights that you brought.
And same for you. For our listeners, just to let you know, sometimes we'll have a conversation during the week and talk through some of the points we want to hit. Today we did very little of that. And so it just kind of organically comes out. I hope the Spirit is directing what we're doing and that you're benefiting from this. We're open for any suggestions and feedback, but dig into the Book of Mormon. It is such a wonderful, it's such a powerful way that we can connect with God. I know that to be the case.
Great. Well, I think next week we're going to start on the Tree of Life. That's chapter 8, but then we also have Nephi seeing his own version of that in chapter 11. So I'm not sure how we're going to cover that, but make sure you read all the different chapters on the vision of the Tree of Life.
Well, that's how we get the title for our podcast.
That is true. That's coming Ta-da. Up, isn't it?
Yes. On our 51st episode. So here we go. Well, the number 50 is a jubilee year, right? So maybe that's it's right. Fitting that we talk on the 51st episode about the Tree of Life and clinging to the iron rod.
That is a good place to go. And gosh, I guess that means we are really getting close to coming up on our 1 year anniversary.
Your anniversary, exactly. So, all right. Well, thank you, MD.
Thank you. And all our listeners, we will catch you next week.
Take care.